We turn again this morning to the passage we read from earlier on in Mark chapter 2, looking from verse 18 through to verse 6 of chapter 3. When Winston Churchill became Prime Minister in 1940, he was deeply unpopular with the rest of the Conservative Party, and particularly with the establishment in Great Britain at that time. I've taken a little bit of an interest in this recently, and I've been doing a little bit of reading into Churchill and his successors, just to kind of see a little bit of the flavor of what things were like at that time in Britain. But Winston Churchill's second speech as Prime Minister was a hugely significant one, when on the 4th of June he declared to the House of Commons, "We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender." You can almost hear his voice as you think of those words or hear those words. And whilst many in Britain took tremendous encouragement from his words and bolstered themselves up for the lengthy period that lay ahead of the war, yet there were still many within the establishment who could not bear Winston Churchill, who couldn't stand anything that he said or anything that he stood for. A month later, Churchill made another speech to the House of Commons, in which he said this, "Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duties and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour." What a tremendous orator Winston Churchill was. But behind it all lay this desire within Churchill that he would bring in a time of peace again. Peace, yes, for the United Kingdom, but peace for the world. And he knew that for that to take place, he was going to have to take his stand against this dictator, Hitler. No matter what happened, he was going to take his stand. And it didn't matter what anybody else thought. It didn't matter what the rest of the Conservative Party thought. It didn't matter what Anthony Eden thought or Harold Macmillan thought. Churchill was determined to take this stand. Just like Winston Churchill, Jesus was not an establishment figure. We found this out as we looked at the previous passage in Mark chapter 2 last week, and we saw Jesus sitting down in the home of Levi and sitting there, remember, with the sinners and the tax collectors and the Pharisees were pointing and saying to the disciples, "How can he sit down with these people?" Well, Jesus was hated by the establishment. As we're going to see by the end of this passage we're looking at today in verse 6 of chapter 3, straight away the Pharisees are plotting how they might kill Jesus. That's how much they hate him. And for the larger part of 3 years of his ministry, he spent them in conflict with the religious leaders of the day. And it's abundantly clear that Jesus didn't come to bolster up the religious establishment of the day. Now, let me just clear this up before I move on. Jesus was not anti-religion, as I've heard some preachers proclaim. No. Religion simply is a belief system. And as we look at the scriptures, we can see over and over again that Jesus didn't come to abolish the law, but he came that the law should be fulfilled. We find James talking about religion. He says, "Religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their affliction and to keep oneself unstained from the world." So the problem is not religion, and Jesus was not anti-religion, but he was anti-bad religion, or more specifically, he was anti-religiosity, where people pursue religion just for the sake of pursuing religion. But what Jesus came to do was to bring something new. New life that would be through him alone, not through empty tradition. A new start. He would lift burdens and bring blessing. New motivation. Lives filled with grace, no longer condemned by the law, and how that would change how they would live their lives in the world. And he came to broker a peace for us, a deal that would remove this ultimate problem, this ultimate dictator, Satan himself, and bring us into this new kingdom. And surely, we must say, as we think of Christ's death on the cross, his resurrection from the grave, his ascension on high, we must surely say, This was our finest hour. And if today you're a Christian, if you know Jesus Christ as your Savior, you must surely say that that day and hour, whenever Jesus Christ saved you from your sins, that was your finest hour. But boys, did the Pharisees hate Jesus? They were looking for a way to catch him out. And they think that they find it in this passage. Well, where do they think they find it? Well, I think they find it in the topic of fasting. Now we read in verse 18, "Now John's disciples and the Pharisees were fasting. Some people came and asked Jesus, 'How is it that John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees are fasting, but yours aren't?'" Now we find something happening here that is in common between the Pharisees and the disciples of John the Baptist. Both of these groups of people are fasting. We don't know exactly why it is that they're fasting. The Pharisees were required to fast once a year. As we know in the parable that Jesus tells about the Pharisee and the publican who went up to the temple to pray, we know that some of the Pharisees may well have chosen for a sake of self-righteousness to fast more often than that. Do you remember the Pharisee in the temple? And how he prayed, "Lord, I thank you that I'm not like this publican over here. You know what I do. You know how much I give to your work. You know that I fast twice a week." So there were some of the Pharisees, and they fasted more often than they were necessarily required to do by the law. So maybe that's why these particular Pharisees were fasting. But I'm pretty sure that's not why John the Baptist's followers or disciples were fasting. Perhaps it was because at this time John the Baptist was in prison, and maybe they were fasting for that reason. Maybe they did set aside a day in the week when they fasted. But the issue with the Pharisees is this: why are we fasting? Why even are the disciples of John fasting whilst Jesus Christ and his disciples are feasting? Thinking particularly of that passage earlier on with in the house of Matthew, where Jesus sits down with the tax collectors and the sinners, and he eats. Jesus responds in a loving manner, doesn't he? What a wonderful way he responds in verse 19. Jesus answered, "How can the guests of the bridegroom fast while he is with them?" Now, I've been to lots of weddings over the years, and believe me, I have paid the price for being at so many weddings. And I've experienced lots of different types of reception. Never yet have I heard the bride of the Father stand up and say this. It's lovely to have you all here today at the reception of my beautiful daughter. Well, I've heard them say this, but at the reception of my beautiful daughter, I really hope that you enjoy your crackers and cheese. Now, I reckon you would feel a little bit shortchanged if you arrived at a reception and the bride's father said that, wouldn't you? Yeah, you would. I certainly would, because you expect the table to be groaning with food, don't you? And you expect an hour later that your belt is going to be groaning because the food is now in there. And that's kind of what you expect at weddings. And Jesus here is saying to these Pharisees, look, I am here. This is the promised Messiah. This is a time for rejoicing, not for mourning. This is a time for feasting, not for fasting, because I am here. Or there will be a time that will come, Jesus says, when there's cause for people to be fasting. And Jesus here is thinking about his death and the fact that one day his body is going to be put into a tomb, that he will be dead. But Jesus says, this isn't the day for that. No, I'm here, says Jesus. This is a time for rejoicing. I'm here. I've brought something new, something exciting. Wasn't that the problem with the Pharisees? They didn't like the new thing that Jesus brought. And so he says to them in verse 22, no one pours new wine into old wineskins. Verse 21, he says, no one sews a patch of unshrunk cloth onto an old garment. And the bottom line is that the Pharisees don't like being told that their old way of doing things is past, and they're unwilling to pay any credence whatsoever to the new. And it reminds me a little bit of the time following the 1859 revival in Ulster. It's a little bit removed from what we're talking about here, but it still seems a little relevant. Thousands of people were converted in the 1859 revival. There was definitely this wonderful move of the Spirit of God across the province of Ulster. And as a result of what happened, the churches changed. New buildings were constructed. And what went on in the buildings changed. Prior to that, the vast majority of Presbyterian churches still sang exclusive psalms. Most of them didn't even have an organ prior to that. But suddenly it changed. I read the minutes a number of years ago of the debates that took place in the General Assembly following the 59 revival. Should we allow people to sing hymns? Should we allow them to have an organ at the front of the church? Well, these were heavy debates. There were people falling out with each other through these debates. I reckon most of us today are quite thankful that the hymns were introduced. I'm not going to ask you if you are or not, because I don't want to create the division here this morning. But what I'm trying to say is this, that at times, whenever new things are being introduced, there are those who may be a little bit longer in the tooth and they're not so comfortable with the new things. And I can remember whenever I was a young person, one time I was. I can remember back to those days and the praise that we young people liked to sing. Well, the older ones in the congregation, they were doing a little bit of whining about the new praise that had been introduced. Why can't we just sing the same old hymns we've always sung? And now the new praise that was introduced then is old praise today. And maybe you are one of those who thinks, well, we have for years sung new praise like Here Is Love or As the Deer. Well, do you know that As the Deer was written 37 years ago? Do you know that Here Is Love was written in 1876. So sometimes the stuff that we think is new can be pretty old. And in the 18th century, when revival came to England, hymns began to be sung in congregations. In fact, for about 30 years following the revival in England, Charles Wesley wrote over 6,000 hymns. The people in the churches at the time hated his hymns, at least a large number of them. They struggled to accept them, which prompted John Wesley to compile a little book called Rules for Methodist Singers. Let me read you four of the rules that he had in the book. One, learn the tunes. Two, sing them as printed. Three, sing all. If it is a cross to you, take it up and you will find it a blessing. Rule number seven, above all, sing spiritually. Have an eye to God in every word you sing. Aim at pleasing him more than yourself or any other creature. Now look, I get it. I like to think I'm middle-aged. That means I'm going to live to be 100, by the way. That's the bad news. I reckon I'm middle-aged, and I do still have a pull back towards the older hymns because I'm now an older guy. Okay, I get it. Believe me. But I also really enjoy some of the newer stuff. And I enjoy it because I actually think that a lot of the newer stuff is much more theologically accurate than the stuff that was sung in my youth back in the 80s. Do you remember the 80s? Then you're as old as me. And we need to be careful we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I'm certainly not saying that we go all new. You will recognize that as I choose praise, I tend to try to choose a little new and a little old and a little in between. And that's because surely we need to accept light from all of the different generations of praise. And Jesus is saying to the Pharisees, not specifically talking about praise, but he's saying, I'm bringing something new. And his new message, he's saying, my new message can't simply be stitched into the old garment of religion. What I'm bringing can't simply become a part of the old. This is something that is new. Now, what was wrong with the garment that the Pharisees had stitched together? Well, what was wrong with it was that it was largely about good works. Here's 613 laws. Keep these 613 laws and you'll be right with God. And so the Pharisees worked so hard to keep all of these rules and regulations, and they pointed the finger at anybody who didn't, and they said, oh, look at them. Well, I'm better than they are. Look at me. And it was all about self-righteousness, and they put this immense burden on the shoulders of the average person who felt that they could never quite shape up. And Jesus is saying, what I've come to bring, what I've come to do is new. And it can't simply become a part of the old. This is new. It wasn't about self-righteousness. Maybe you sit here today and you think, well, I'm a good person. You know, when I stand before God one day, he'll accept me into heaven. He'll look at me and say, oh, yeah. You're a decent spud. You've done good things. Well, if that's how you think, let me ask you, why? Why did Jesus die on a cross? If you can save yourself, why did Jesus bother coming into this world at all? But if we can do nothing to save ourselves, well, then that's exactly why we need Jesus. Someone has said, if there is one stitch in our celestial garment that we must insert ourselves, then we are lost. Jesus didn't die on the cross to get us started that we may go on to earn salvation for ourselves. Our righteousness is complete in Christ alone. Well, they thought they could pull him up on fasting. They also thought here they could pull him up on plucking. A pastor was one Sunday making his way to church after a heavy snowfall during the night. Seeing the roads ahead totally blocked, he was forced to skate to church on the frozen river. As he arrived at church in his skates, he was met by the horrified elders, looking at him and then looking at his skates. He told them that if he hadn't skated to worship, there would have been no service that Sunday. So one of the elders asked him, "Well, tell me, Pastor, as you skated here today on those skates, did you enjoy it?" To which he replied, "Certainly not." So the session decided it was okay. Sometimes we miss the trees for the wood, don't we? And that was exactly the problem with the Pharisees. Jesus is speaking to the people about forgiveness and new life. He is touching them and healing them and changing their lives. And what are the Pharisees doing? They're not looking at Jesus and saying, "Is this the Messiah? Is this God?" No, they're looking at what he's doing. They're looking at him pulling ears of corn. They're listening to him. They're seeing him healing people, and they're saying, "He's breaking the Sabbath day." They can't see the trees for the wood. They're not getting what is relevant about all of this. So did Jesus break the Sabbath? Well, I don't believe so. Verse 23, one Sabbath, Jesus was going through the cornfields, and as his disciples walked along, they began to pick some ears of corn. If you were to look up Deuteronomy 23, verse 25, you'd discover that the disciples were permitted to do exactly what they're doing here. You know, if I was to go for a walk along the road and I were to see blackberries growing at the side of the road, well, I would feel I was perfectly entitled to pull some of those off the bush and to eat them. As Presbyterians particularly, the old black mouths, we feel that we're entitled to do that sort of a thing, don't we? And I think it's okay, as long as we don't later come along with a chainsaw and cut down the whole bush. That's where the problem comes in. And Deuteronomy 23 says that it is all right to walk through a field and to lift ears of corn as long as you don't harvest them on a Sunday. Now the Pharisees looked at Jesus and his disciples and they came to the conclusion that Jesus was harvesting on the Sabbath. Now again, Jesus doesn't rise to their small-mindedness, but gently reminds them of the time David and his men were hungry on the Sabbath, and they took the showbread from off the altar. And Jesus was saying that David didn't break the spirit of the Sabbath, and neither did his disciples. So he concludes in verse 27, "The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath." You see, the Sabbath is one of those things that we refer to as a creation ordinance. It's not just for those who call themselves Christians, but the Sabbath is for all mankind. You see, God made us so that we would have a day of rest, a day that we set aside from our normal activities, a day that we spend worshiping God and glorifying God. And so the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. Hazel got me a new watch for my birthday. It's a rather nice one. I love my gadgets. And this watch just ticks all the boxes for me. But one of the things about my watch is that every night I need to put it on the charger. Okay, if I don't put it in the charger, the next day I'll be sitting in somebody's house and I'll go to look at the time and see if I need to be somewhere else, and there'll be nothing on the watch. So in order to make it work, I need to charge it. And in order for us to be able to do what we need to do during the week, we need one day, the Sabbath, set aside from our work, whatever your work is. The works that are permitted in the Lord's Day are works of necessity or works of mercy. And I'll let you work out what all that is. But nothing else. So for the young person whose work is their schoolwork, can I be radical enough to suggest to you that the Sunday is the day that you don't lift out the books from your bag? You, if you need to, you get up early on a Monday morning. You stay up late on a Saturday night. But you make the Sunday a day for God without the work. And our priorities in life, whatever age we are, should mean that we set out this one day as special for the Lord. Do you do that? Here Jesus is challenging these Pharisees. They've added on all these extra rules. For example, you're not allowed to walk more than a quarter of a mile on the Sabbath. Well, the Bible doesn't say that. But they were adding on a whole host of extra things that the Bible didn't say. And every now and then people will say to me, well, can I do this in the Sabbath? Or can I do that in the Sabbath? Or should I watch TV in the Sabbath? Or can I not watch TV in the Sabbath? And people come to me with all of these questions about the Sabbath. All I can say about the Sabbath is what the Bible says about the Sabbath. And that is that we have 6 days in which to do our work, but the seventh is God's. It's a day we set aside for him. And so it seems to me that our problem is possibly the opposite of the Pharisees here. That today, instead of us having set up a whole raft of new laws in the Sabbath as to what you have to do, we have ditched the Sabbath completely. It's as though we've only the 9 commandments. We've skipped out on the 4th. J.C. Ryle said, there is little danger of the day being kept too strictly in the present age. There's far more danger of it being profaned and forgotten entirely. Let us contend earnestly for its preservation amongst us all in its integrity. Jesus was saying that the Sabbath was given as a means of benefit and blessing to man, but the Pharisees instead turned it into a heavy burden. Plucking, fasting, and lastly, healing. Verse 2 of chapter 3, some of them were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, so they watched him closely to see if he would heal this man on the Sabbath. Jesus has greatly angered the Pharisees, so they're looking for a hat trick of sins here. They think they've caught him in the fasting thing. They think they've got him in the plucking of the ears of corn. So now they're looking for the third strike so that Jesus will be knocked out of the race. And they think that they have found it. This man comes up to Jesus in the synagogue on the Sabbath day. He comes up with a shriveled hand, and they think that if Jesus heals this man, well, then they have got him hook, line, and sinker. I hope none of you are like that. I hope none of you have got so caught up in laws and rules and regulations that you're simply looking around to see who is going to break one of those rules or laws. And you're just waiting to point it out. Maybe it makes you feel a little bit better because you've made somebody else feel a little bit worse. I hope you're not sitting like the Pharisees were, ready to pounce. But let me make it clear what Christ is not saying here. He is not saying that the Sabbath is unimportant and not sacred. He is not saying that it is a day when we should abstain from all work. And he is not saying that the Sabbath is not about rest. His beef with the Pharisees in chapter 3 is not one of principle, but practice. He acknowledges the principle of the Sabbath day, but he doesn't agree with their practice on the Sabbath day. So Jesus is not canceling the use of the Sabbath, but he's dealing with what he sees to be the abuse of the Sabbath. Jesus shows that it is right to do good on the Sabbath as well as works of necessity. It is not these works that save us, but when we are saved, we should practice such works. And sometimes people very, very wisely say to me, but don't you work on the Sabbath? Well, it's the only day I work in the week. I think that makes it all right. No, but in all seriousness, what I'm doing, or at least what I hope I'm doing, is I'm doing good works for the Lord on the Sabbath. That this is my service to God. But here Jesus is challenging these Pharisees. They think that it's about a list of rules and regulations and do's and don'ts. And Jesus is saying, no. It's about me. It's about the new thing that I'm bringing. It's about the new kingdom that I'm setting up. And I want to ask you today, are you a member of that kingdom? I'm not asking you if you're a communicant member. I'm not asking you if you're a baptized. I'm not asking you about what rules you keep and what rules you break. I'm not a priest who listens to your confessions. It's not about that. But I'm asking you, do you have a relationship with the Father through Christ? Do you know him? Do you love him? And have you experienced forgiveness through him? If you want that forgiveness today, if you want that relationship with God today, why not come and see me after the service or any other Christian here? I can't save you, but I can point you to the one who does. Why not trust in him for salvation?